The new Manchurian Candidate, directed by Jonathan Demme, reunites him with his star from Philadelphia, Denzel Washington. It also stars Meryl Streep and Liev Schreiber. Yes, it is set in a different time, but it is still an action-adventure story in a political context. And here's the trailer for the new Manchurian Candidate.
When I sleep, I dream. I don't want to dream. Something happened out there in the desert that night during that mission, and it's not what we thought it was, and it happened on my watch.
You've been down this road with you before, yes?
No, no, sir. Not this road.
Sergeant Shaw, you ever dream about Kuwait?
Captain Marco!
How much do you actually know about your friend?
I served under him. He was a good man.
That's what the neighbors always say about serial killers.
Somebody put an implant inside me. I got a good feeling you put one in you, too.
You need to get help, then.
I'm not crazy, Shaw.
Raymond, this is J.B. Johnson of Manchurian Global.
We should go and support us.
Click the switch. We can adjust character, change personality.
These are not supposed to exist.
Raymond Prentice, Shaw. Listen.
This is a coup. This is rich people funding bad science to put a sleeper in the White House.
Among the shareholders in Manchurian Global, you would find former presidents, supposed kings.
Yeah, I get it. They're big. They're huge.
Can you bring me rumors and conjectures?
I started with nightmares. Rumors, conjectures. That's a giant leap forward.
Somebody got into our heads.
Neurons got exposed and circuits got rewired.
I think you should leave.
What are you doing?
I gotta find out what's gonna happen, where it's gonna happen.
He's delusional.
Watch where you going!
You swore to me that this was fail-safe. No leaks, no glitches. I will do whatever is necessary to protect my son.
We're going to stop this and take him out.
I don't think they factored you in.
Hello, Captain. Do you remember me?
Believe me. Help me. Don't shoot me.
Joining me now is the director, Jonathan Demme, and actor, Denzel Washington. I am pleased to have both of them here. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, here's Newsweek magazine. Conspiracy Redux. Remaking a great thriller sounds crazy. See the Manchurian Candidate. An exclusive look at summer's dark surprise.
Can we quote you on that?
Better Newsweek. Whose idea was this?
I think it was Tina Sinatra's idea. Yeah.
How far back did she, how long ago did she get the ball rolling? Because I don't know either.
What I understand is that when they did a re-release of the first version in 1987, she went to see it in Westwood. It was wowing the audience, and she went and called her dad and said, you know what, I think this picture could be remade, and he gave the project his blessing. And she's been trying ever since to get it made. And finally, Dan Pine wrote a draft that really kind of reinvented the wheel.
Was he there before you? I mean, did you?
Yes, indeed. And then Mr. Washington read the script and said, "This looks good to me, I believe." And I got a phone call. And
first they have the writer, then they have Mr. Washington.
Yeah.
And then you're on.
I'm on. I get a phone call from my agent, and he calls up and says, "Jonathan, you're being offered Denzel Washington's next picture." I went, "Oh my God, fantastic! A dream come true. What are we going to be doing?" A remake of the Manchurian Candidate. Oh God, no!
You loved it or not? You didn't.
No, I didn't. I really, you know, my instant reaction was, there's no way on earth that can be pulled off.
Because it was such a classic and so great.
Such a classic and so great, but more specifically, so wed to its moment in time that I just couldn't imagine how they could do it. I read it, and it was, and on page three, I was completely hooked.
You saw the script, you saw the new settings, now the Gulf War and not the Korean War and it's not the Chinese, it's something else.
It's multinational corporations that profit from war, but also what Dan Pine did was to bring the character of Ben Marco right up front and get inside his head and go through this terrifying story with him instead of the first picture, which works wonderfully, watches all this happen. And it was Pine's idea to make it a very subjective experience and to really also change the characters a lot.
Not to go too much behind the scenes, but Scott Rudin came in at some point too, didn't he?
He teamed up with Tina Sinatra when the picture went to Paramount, and I'm sure that helped energize things enormously. And I know that Dan Pine had actually worked with Scott previously. And this guy wrote a great original screenplay. I love talking about the old version with Denzel because he's never seen it.
You've never seen the movie?
No, I never saw it. Well, because it was eight. I was eight when it came out.
There's a neat thing called DVD.
Yeah, but I'm not a big movie buff, and it just so happens that I never saw it when I read the screenplay.
And was not tempted to see it after you read the screenplay.
I read the screenplay. I loved it. I said, whoa, what a heck of an idea.
Yeah.
When they said, well, this is a remake, it's been made before, obviously there was no Desert Storm and all those things, but it really didn't matter to me because I thought this was a great screenplay and a great idea, so I wanted to be a part of it.
What's the story?
Story is...
Anybody who didn't see the first or has not yet seen your movie so that they may be...
Well, you know, I think...
...enticed to come in.
Which I hope occurs.
Well, me says it. Everybody. I mean, every review I've read has been favorable.
We just started showing the picture. The first reactions have been very strong. We're encouraged by that, so we'll see. But it's really... Denzel plays a very damaged soldier, a soldier who is scarred by his experiences in the Gulf War and who is haunted by nightmares. And he's haunted to the extent that he's getting unraveled. And he goes, he believes that his nightmares have a basis in truth. And he makes this very determined, very dangerous effort to try to prove to everybody else, the powers that be, that his dreams are, in fact, a terrible reality.
All right. Roll tape. This is Denzel as Ben Marco trying to convince Raymond Shaw, Liev Schreiber, a man who was there at the time that they experienced an incredible thing in Kuwait. Here it is.
Somebody put an implant inside me. I found it this morning. I got the hole in my back. If you want to take a look at it, and I got a good feeling they put one in you, too.
Nobody's put anything in me, Ben.
Let's prove it. Why don't we, you know, we'll go get an X-ray.
I want to be supportive of you. I do. But don't you think this could wait till after the election?
Why? For what? For what? What are you scared of?
I'm not afraid of anything.
Then why don't we just prove it? Why don't we
find out? I think you should leave. I'm sorry.
Somebody got into our heads. With big steel-toed boots, cable cutters, and a chainsaw, and they went to town. Neurons got exposed, and circuits got rewired. Our brain cells got obliterated, Raymond. Please.
You need to get help, Ben.
Tell me about Liev's character before we come back to Denzel.
We meet Raymond Shaw very briefly. He's the sergeant in Captain Marco's platoon, and he's clearly a deeply depressed, alienated individual. At a glance, you can see he's troubled. We move swiftly into the present, and suddenly he is 12 years later, he's a two-term congressman from New York. He's being proposed as the vice presidential nominee on the ticket.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero. Not thank you. Mm-hmm. Yep. And one of the things when Captain Marco is visited early in the present of our picture by Jeffrey Wright, who is so brilliant once again, in our movie, his whole point, Corporal Melvin's whole point is, you know, you should have been the hero, you know. It doesn't make any sense that Raymond Shaw was the hero. And he tries to appeal to Captain Marco that, you know, do you have dreams? And Marco denies that he does. And Jeffrey Wright goes on his way. And things take off from there. And I think that clearly the national news of this former depressed, alienated guy suddenly being a charismatic vice presidential candidate has an impact on Denzel's character, too. He sees all this stuff on television, and it lends credibility in his own mind to the nightmares that have been haunting him.
And you've set out to do what?
Initially, just going through life almost like a zombie, trying to figure out what's wrong.
Like, you know, I sleep like I'm having nightmares, and what's going on here?
But when Al Melvin's character shows up and shows me a picture that registers something, that triggers something like that we share, he starts to look for answers, and he goes to Raymond Shaw, and he's acting strange, and, you know, one thing leads to another, and he finds out what's going on. What's going on?
This is a classic action thriller set in a political context.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm running with that. You know what this is, Charlie? It's a classic action thriller set in a political context.
Okay. Was it, Merrill, your idea?
By the time
Raymond's mother.
I got to tell you, not only was Denzel Washington already captured picture Charlie, but there was a lineup of all the greatest actresses of Merrill's generation, and there are many here in this country, had all read the script. They all wanted to meet. So I had this privilege of having a series of meetings with all these great actors.
You didn't audition them, did you?
No, I didn't. No. These are, we're talking, you know, Meryl Streep caliber.
Meryl, yeah. You come in and read for this.
And
read for that part.
For he always says that's the best part of the movie.
That's the best part. I'll play that part in a second.
Why is it this such a great part? I mean, what makes Meryl's part so good?
Well,
we know how good Meryl is in this part,
right? Well, just on paper, Dan Pyne, and the way he reconceived this character, just wrote the juiciest part in that regard for flamboyant character that I've seen in ages. I mean, this is
a mother who loves her son, wants to see her son be president, etc.
Yes, and it's also a passionate patriot. It's a woman who believes that she alone has the most acute vision of the dire threat facing our country today, and she alone understands how to save the country. And she believes this, you know, with all her heart and soul. And she comes from a place of tremendous power. She's been in a family that kind of, imagine like the Kennedy family,
right, exactly,
or the Prescott Bush family, a dynasty.
Right.
And her feeling is, you know, had she not been born a woman, she would be president. Next best thing, her son will be president. So it's great. And what's really terrific.
Does she want to be president more than her son?
He's
a little bit sort of distant at the same time.
Well, but he's with the help of friends of Meryl's character, he's gotten a whole lot better. He's been, you know, really improved. But she is that parent who has the opportunity to bring the child they loved and who left home at the appropriate age kind of home again. This is one of the opportunities that's been offered to her by sort of the dark forces of the film. And I think it's okay to say that she feels that there's nothing wrong with this, that he can grow to be a great leader. She will be there by his side. And that's their situation.
In a movie like this, you playing opposite John Voight, Meryl Streep.
Ain't that nice?
Ain't that nice?
Ain't that nice? Well, actually, I'm an extra in a Meryl Streep scene. I'm just an extra. She actually just walks by. I tried to make a three-act play out there, but Jonathan cut me out.
Can we have more?
Yeah.
What do you get from a director in a movie like this? What does he bring?
What is it? You mean, what do I?
No,
I mean,
no, yes, you shaped this character. We just said this is a whole story of Marco unraveling, and
right,
it's a great race between,
well,
if you're going to find out what the hell happened before he does something that is.
We sat around one day, I remember, in the apartment. Remember how we were deciding what was going to be in my apartment? And it turned out to be very interesting and fascinating. There was a scene in the opening of the film. He talks to the Boy Scouts. You go in the past, you see. Then he talks to Al Melvin's character, and he leaves. There was actually a short scene in his car outside the school where he breaks down, you know, and you go, oh, something's not quite what we thought with this. Well, Jonathan decided to cut that out, which is fine. So now we see him go to the store and go home. But when you get to his home and you see the papers stacked up and it's mm-hmm. all, you go, oh, you get that same thing in a more subtle way, I think, more interesting way. You realize, wait a minute, this guy is not. He's his body language, the newspapers, the junkie out. So that's one of the things to answer your question. What we decided on would be in that space. What we had decided was
Al Melvin, who seems to be crazed and disheveled, we go to his house, everything's neat. There's drawings on the wall, but the books are stacked, and we go to my character, who seems to have it together, we go to his house, and everything's a mess. So it informs us about the characters, and that was something that we
Charlie, the flip side of that, because that reminds me of something, that what it's like working with Denzel is that as we approach shooting, he's saying, I gotta go to, you know, the residence, I gotta go to see where this place, where this guy lives, and I gotta see what you did there. So we go on over, and we walk through the door, and we had a very character, excellent choice of material there, and it reflected the character and some little discussions we'd had and ideas that Christy Zia, our great production designer, had. And Denzel was like four steps in, he goes, too neat, gotta be messy, there's gotta be a lot of newspapers, a lot of magazines, gotta be a lot. So okay, because I'm too depressed to throw stuff out, and I'm too on a search for information to not get this stuff, so mess it up. I'm not into cleaning either. So we brought a bunch of stuff. Then he comes back the next day, and he goes, more. Walks out, and then finally the place looks like it is. And you know, I got to tell you something. Two different people on the press junket this weekend said to me, you know what one of the most terrifying moments in that picture is? What? When Marco goes home and you see what a mess his place is.
All right, let me take a look at this. This is the scene between Senator Jordan, played by John Voight, and Denzel's character, Ben Marco. Here it is.
Among the shareholders in Manchurian Global, were they to ever publish a list, which they won't, you would find former presidents, deposed kings, trust fund terrorists, fallen communist dictators, ayatollahs, African warlords, and retired prime ministers. See what I mean?
Yeah, I get it. They're big. They're huge. They're gigantic. I can't touch them. I get it. I don't want to.
And you bring me rumors and conjectures.
I started with nightmares. Rumors and conjectures. That's a giant leap forward.
That's what I wanted to set up. You know?
Great point.
Yeah. Now, so here we have, as the great villain in this piece, it is, in the end, these giant corporations who have power and who spend money and use their power to nefarious ends. Is that your view of America and corporate America?
Well, I want to make a distinction in that regard.
This is a political action thriller set in a political context.
It is, and when I read it, I was really sucked in by the psychological thriller, the paranoid psychological thriller aspect, which, again, picturing Denzel made it very easy to get sucked in. I thought it was terrific the way Dan Pine had set this story against the backdrop of that reconceived the great threat to mankind today, not as communism, as in the first version movie, but rather as the threat posed by the proliferation of multinational corporations that profit from war. And I'll make a little bit of a distinction between just corporations. This is zeroing in on a very particular kind. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of research, and there's a lot of information out there that I think a lot of us find disturbing. You know, especially, Charlie, in this kind of crossroads where the people that make the biggest decisions at these multinational corporations that profit from war and that hold the highest offices there and arguably, presumably, make enormously terrific profits from there, very often these are the very same people who a year ago or next year are going to be in the highest of elected offices or appointed high government offices, and that's very disturbing.
We think about a particular political person and a particular company when we say that?
Well, I don't know. You know, in our research, we read a lot about outfits with names like Halliburton, Carlyle Group, Bechtel, the lists are myriad, and it's, you know, you can read about it in any of the
newspapers. In those companies, I mean, Halliburton was in...
Well, the current vice president.
The relationship to Dick Cheney was a former president.
Yeah.
Or CEO of Halliburton. But, I mean, when you say Bechtel in the Carlyle Group, which does have prime ministers and John Majors and former secretaries of state as part of it, but you're not suggesting these companies, that somebody like that, profits from war, are you, in a sense that they're using their power to produce wars so that they can make, or are you?
I don't think the picture, and I am not suggesting.
Bechtel or whoever you're
saying. Global didn't start Desert Storm.
No, and it's this comfortable this uncomfortable, this to me, you know, like disturbingly uncomfortable, and to many, intersection of those that make the decisions that lead our countries into war, and who stand to gain profits from the material and from the personnel and from everything employed by these companies when they go to war. And more and more and more of war is being privatized. And more of the personnel and the material and the support in every way, on every single level, is coming from private enterprises operated or invested in by companies with names like this. And I am not suggesting that they all get together in the boardroom and go, let's start a war in, you know, in Afghanistan or in any place, because then we can sell a lot more products. I'm just saying that, you know, there's that phrase that somebody came up with a couple years ago that was virtuality, this whole idea that you know, if you believe in your worldview strongly enough, then that is the reality. It virtually make it that way. And I feel that many of our leaders are in that head place at the moment. They are so convinced that war is imperative, that it's got to happen. It's got to happen to save the country. And by the way, hey, if I happen to be making a lot of money in the bargain, well, so be it. I'm doing a damn fine job up here. You know, I don't know how it all works, but I do know that there is that thing. And I also know that when Dwight Eisenhower left the presidency, he famously, in his farewell address, said, I leave you with this thought, the greatest threat on the horizon I see to democracy as we know it is the growing military-industrial complex. We must be ever vigilant to not let that power unit get out of control and gain too much control. So I think our movie suggests, and this was present in the screenplay, and I took to it, suggests that maybe we've achieved that moment. And it's a cautionary tale that says maybe they'll go even this far. But again, it's a scary thriller.
Exactly. But join in on this. I mean, what do you feel about multilateral corporations and the threat they may pose in terms of what Eisenhower said, mm-hmm. or what this movie suggests? Or
it's simple to put it like this, but I didn't see the original film, but when the great threat was communism, the pie was always chopped up. It was North Korea against South Korea. Well, who provided the arms to the South Koreans? Who provided the arms to the North Koreans? Who provided the arms to the South Vietnamese? Who provided the arms to the North Vietnamese? So we were told, watch out for that big bomb coming over here, but meanwhile over here, you know, we're selling bullets and guns, and you got that side, I got this side, and yeah. And every, you know. So maybe that's a simple version of it, but nobody else was able to get in and provide those arms. That line was drawn between those two supposed superpowers who were enemies. Now it is more complicated. You know, they have gone back and forth, and I don't know all the ins and outs about whether Halliburton had any real competition in getting the job to do whatever it is they're doing over there. You know, at one point I think there was some controversy about that how did they get in before anybody else?
Some controversy about pricing.
And pricing, but even before that, controversy about how they got the job.
Right.
Was it fair? Was there other companies that got to bid?
Yeah.
You know.
Let me just ask this. Is the idea, you made a film called The Agronomist, which was about politics, but about a human being who was a great human being, who sat in the chair, as you know. We look at the bestseller list. You know, there was Richard Clark's book. There was Bob Woodward's book. There are other books like that. Are we at a time now in which there seems to be a heightened political consciousness? And movies, Fahrenheit 9/11 is doing well. This movie's getting great reviews. I'm sure will do well. And the books, people are somehow stirred up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're interested
mm-hmm.
in politics like they never have been before.
They're also interested in God. It's interesting that two of the most popular books were Da Vinci Code and The Purpose-Driven Life.
That's exactly right.
They're looking for answers.
Yeah.
And if they can't get them from their leaders, they're trying to get them from the leader.
Yeah.
You know, or from some code that Da Vinci, from the Mona Lisa. It's somewhere. We're powerless. We know we're not.
Think we're onto something.
Yeah,
no, I really do.
Yeah, we're powerless in a sense. I think we're in denial. What did go on in Florida 3 years ago? We still don't know.
Right.
You know, and we can say, it couldn't have been that. Well, you can say that about this movie. Nah, that could never happen. Maybe.
you know, but we're looking for answers. We're feeling like, man, this thing's getting away from us.
But if the movie raises questions, I mean, first of all, you want it to be great entertainment. You got great, and you got great actors, great director, great screenplay, as you suggested. You want to entertain people. You
we're slavishly committed to scaring the bejesus out of the audience any way we possibly can.
Slavishly committed to capitalism.
Absolutely.
Show business.
Show business, as you've reminded
That's
me
correct.
Several
no
times.
No business, no show.
No business, no show.
But
if you can also, as Don Hill used to say at 60 Minutes, you can do well and do good at the same time. If you can make a film, whether it's Fahrenheit 9/11 or whether it is a Manchurian Candidate, that gets people thinking and talking,
mm-hmm.
or feeds into what they're thinking so that they want to know more, then we're all benefiting.
Mm. Well, that's what Richard Tonin, I think.
Chose.
Well, Richard Tonin, when he first wrote Manchurian Candidate, I think that that's what it was all about. He wrote a story that was on the surface a almost like a horror movie, a horror story, a science fiction story, a psychological thriller set against a political backdrop. But the point is, the characters, many of the characters in this story are threatened with brainwashing, mind control. And I think Richard Tonin wrote this because he was worried about the mind control that was going on in the American public in those years, in the late 50s, 60s.
Mind control about, because it came after McCarthy and all of that.
We were brainwashed.
Fear of communism.
Yeah, brainwashed by fear. And that's one of the things, you know, we can see when Raymond Shaw is making his speeches, he's talking all about fear, and he's saying, I'm the guy that can save us because I face the enemy, and I know what they look like, and I'm here to say we can do it.
Yeah.
That's provocative stuff and stuff. So, that's the...
And it's the infancy of what we're seeing now. You gotta remember, when that movie came out, television was just really beginning to be a big factor. So you look at how television influenced, or what that writer maybe could see happening then and what has happened now. I don't think there's a coincidence between what we consider some of our greatest leaders and television. Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy,
Robert
even Malcolm X. Yeah, they're all television babies.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan was... Yeah,
you know, that's when what you look like to run for president is as important as what you have to say. You know, Kennedy looked great. Nixon was sweating.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Roll tape. This is the last scene we'll show, and this is where Marco pleads with Shaw for information about the plot we've been talking about. Here it is.
Did they tell you what it is they want you to do? That's what I got to find out. We got to find out what's going to happen, where it's going to happen.
Are we friends, Ben? I want to believe we were friends.
We are connected, and that's something nobody can take from us. You could have had me locked up, but you didn't. That's proof that there's something deep inside. There's a part that they can't get to, and it's deep inside of us. And that's where the truth is. That's our only hope. That's what you and me need to tap into, and that's what you and I are going to use to take them out. Raymond, we don't have much time, please.
Man, that's good acting. That's good acting.
We're going.
I'm going real.
I was too.
Get it out of him, mate. Does he get it?
There's a small part of you.
Yeah. Now, you had to change the location. I mean, you had to change a different war. You got different. It was also black and white version, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
You didn't have color. But did you change the ending?
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Well, Dan Pine changed the ending a little bit. And my feeling was, when I got involved, I thought it needs to be more complicated than this. I don't want to exactly give the ending away, but it took the picture to a place that was just appalling to be. It was very strong and it had a lot of integrity. It was just appalling, and I felt that I had such an emotional connection with Marco that by the time the picture ended, I didn't want to say that kind of goodbye to him.
Right.
As an audience member, I just couldn't
let go.
And yet we also had to be tough, and we couldn't turn it into a happy ending, because this is not a feel good picture. This is a picture, and what have you. So the ending got changed.
But you fell in love with the character. You fell in love with his pursuit. You fell in love with
The decency of this guy, and also of the
Travail.
the travail, but it's also the character of Marco just puts me so vividly in mind of our people in uniform today. Young women, young men, older women and older men that are presently in Iraq and other countries in uniform, risking their lives, sometimes losing their lives, sometimes being terribly damaged, involved in the killing of civilians and what have you. And it's all, I see that as all these good people whose lives have been interrupted and sent off to engage in something that, to me, the justification of which gets murkier and murkier as the days go by. And I want to see those people come back. And I feel that, for me, Marco embodies the potential of the American people in uniform at their very finest, led astray and damaged and tampered with.
And you saw Marco how? I mean, part obviously that, but more.
Well, I mean, I'm just in his head. He can't see all of that going on. He knows something's wrong with him. I just started with what is wrong with me, you know, as Marco. What's wrong with him? I mean, it's not what they said, you know. But I think he was accepting it. I think he was just slowly heading down a slippery slope, you know. And
some part of him says, "Don't give up."
Well, he hadn't given up. He still got up every morning, and you know, that's all he had left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't much to his speech. It's the same speech, you know, and he goes by the supermarket and gets his noodles and goes home.
To
his messy apartment, you know. He hadn't given up, but he didn't have a leg to stand on, you know. And that one photograph, Melvin showing up at that moment, you know, maybe 3 years prior, it wouldn't have worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always wondered how often he got tweaked, checked up from the neck up, like Raymond Shaw does.
Right.
Raymond Shaw gets checked up the most because they got to make sure he's right where they need him. Then Marco, we get him when we need him. The other guys, we'll just let them slowly go crazy. You know, we let them go, like Melvin. Don't even touch him. He'll take care of himself.
Are you in character most of the time when you're near the
set? Not necessarily all the time, but no, not all the time.
But the mindset is there. I mean, you're living with the mindset you're in, which is Marco's pursuit.
Yeah, and I personally don't like to talk too much about what I'm about to do. I don't want to talk it away. Because, first of all, I don't necessarily know.
You don't?
No.
Part of what you do is a surprise to yourself?
Well, sort of.
Just give it...
It's like this. Now, you looked over there, but I tapped over here.
Your hand went up.
Right. So you got to stay in the moment. I don't want to be out there and go, hey, 45 minutes into the interview, I'm going to do this because I'm going to get him to look a certain way. Because when I go to do it, it won't be spontaneous
like it wasn't
the second time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't want to decide how I'm going to react to you because I don't know what you're going to bring.
Nor do I.
Exactly.
I mean, it's all. I have no idea where I'm going to take this.
You prepare.
Yeah.
I do my notes. I prepare.
Right.
And then we walk.
Let it go. As you know, because you've been here a lot of times.
Yeah.
Right. When you made this movie, is this the movie you intended to make? I mean, did you end up saying, okay,
you know,
I got what I wanted, folks.
Say I read the script of Manchurian Candidate, and this little movie starts playing involuntarily in my head, and I think that movie's exciting enough to make a movie out of it.
Right.
The good news is that the movie that we wind up with is so much better, it's no one in my head.
Right?
Yeah, because...
In this case.
Yeah, because I've just got one little perspective on it. You know, then here come all these other perspectives, and it gets richer and richer and richer. And we all had enough confidence in the script to go forth with it, and then feel free to take the picture to another level. Nothing's more tragic, as far as I'm concerned, when you see a film where they had a great script and felt that more or less by doing the actions described and saying the words described, they had nailed it. You got to take a script, I think, to a whole other level. It has to become, you know, out there in the ozone. And one of the things that was, I know I was listening to what Denzel said, and I understand what he means when he says he doesn't know what he's going to do, because I've seen the magical stuff that occurs that can only occur of the moment, can only occur of the moment. But I tell you one thing about him, he knows what he's not gonna do. And there was this one day early on that I think is really interesting. And In the script, Dan had written in about, there were about 12 or 15 serious, specially crafted, really smart, flamboyant moments for an unraveling man to display exactly how extreme he is getting. And I was looking forward to every one of those. Denzel came in on the first day, I don't know if you remember this, and goes, John, come here, you got your script, come here. See that? I'm not going to do that. See that? I'm not going to do that. See that? I'm not. And he's pointing out all these, like, supercharged moments. And I'm like, okay. And he says, I said, why not? And he said, because I am much too depressed to do that.
As the character,
yeah. That I got a lot going on inside of me, but it's not about reeling back out of chairs when I discover something horrifying, and it's not about screaming when I make a breakthrough, what have you. So without in any way rewriting the part of Marco, he just took this certain layer of goodies out and went with what I call a minimalistic approach, born of his respect for what it's like to live with depression, and what it's like to be in the kind of circumstances that a damaged man like Ben Marco is in. And what's beautiful is that he, in having the courage to go with the integrity of that belief, he trusted that we would be getting all the emotional impact required from a character study of a guy under these circumstances, and it works so beautifully. And there were a couple of times, Charlie, when I would say to Denzel, I'd come in and I go, you know, when Liev says that line about the patrol, I think you should probably indicate a little bit of a reaction there. And Denzel's like, I am. I said, well, I was watching the monitor really close, Denzel. I didn't see anything. He said, you'll see it on the screen. And I was like, oh, man, what's he doing to me now? Go to Daly's next night. There it is. There it is, right there in the eyes.
Because if it's described, Marco taps one hand here and the other one there, and he's deeply distressed. Now you're forced to perform something as opposed to allowing something. Maybe that's not what he does. Maybe in his way there he knocks the cup over. But I don't like being told how to, because it's indication. That's the writer saying, this is how I would do it.
Well, this is how I think. Of how you feel instead of you being allowed to feel it.
And that's good for the people that are making the film so they get a sense. You know, because you do need things like that so people understand where we're going. So everybody needs department to get a sense of it. But for this actor, it's like, no. You can't tell me how I'm going to do something. I don't even tell myself how, because I don't know. I got to get in the room. I got to get in the room with John Voight. I can't say, oh, you'll go crazy with all the papers. You know what I mean? I don't know what he's going to, you know, he may go crazy with all the papers. I may go, oh, you understand me, don't you? You know, you want to wait and see what's going to happen and not decide what's going to happen.
I found myself wanting and needing to move the camera, constantly pushing in on Marco's face so we could get a better look at those eyes, because there was so much going on in there. And I think, again, for an audience, it's really exciting. It's trusting the piece, it's trusting the character, it's trusting the audience to be able to perceive what's going on in there. And I love this portrayal very, very much.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Great day.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, my friend. Good to see you. Bye.
Thanks, Charlie.
The movie is called Manchurian Candidate.
If you don't want to watch it after hearing what took place at this show, there's nothing that I can say that will bring you there.